Hey everyone, it's time to kick off another exciting edition of our DevOps Office Hours. It's July 12th, 2023. I'm Eric Osterman and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps companies conquer AWS using our rock solid Terraform blueprints. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not that happy with your current setup, go to cloudposse.com/quiz to book a session with me directly and I can show you what your future can look like. For those of you new to the call, the format's very informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of you joining through the podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week, so don't miss out. Register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Our call today is recorded. We'll post a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to support what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. Also, it's a great way to share any of these sessions with your team. If you found something interesting and you want to get everyone on the same page, you can find the recordings of our office hours at youtube.com/cloudposse. All right, so announcements. On 7/26, so I think in about 2 weeks, we are going to have Maxim Vlasov join us. He has gone deep on RenovateBot, doing some really advanced configurations there. He's going to do a 15-20 minute abbreviated presentation. He has like a 60-minute version. We're going to do a short one, followed by Q&A. So if you're curious to learn more about RenovateBot, it would be a good session to attend. One exciting announcement that I saw was Kubernetes adding first-class sidecar support. I didn't know this feature had been in the works or was being worked on. And at first glance, I'm like, wait, why is this a feature? You can already do that today. I mean, that pattern's used everywhere, right? The problem with sidecars today is that they don't start concurrently with like your init containers. They can hold up the termination of your pods. Lots of issues with finalizers related to that. So having native sidecar support in Kubernetes is really beneficial because you can have, for example, the sidecar bring up your Istio sidecar, your Envoy sidecar, and require that to be online before your pod starts. And you could do that for security and compliance purposes. Perhaps you have some scanning software running aside your containers, your processes, and you want that to always be there prior to starting your applications. And the list goes on and on and on. Anyway, so don't expect to see this immediately available, obviously, on EKS and so forth. We first have to wait for the next EKS release. This was only merged into main 5 days ago, so I expect a couple months.
We need a Kubernetes release that includes it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what is the release cadence on those? Let's see here. So last month. Yeah, so multiple releases a month. So maybe, but I'm not sure if it's a major or minor. I didn't see what it was tagged as. So. Okay. Next one is a cool little AI-powered chat for AWS documentation. I haven't used it thoroughly, and I'm not day-to-day on these things, so maybe it helps me a little bit less. But for what it's worth, when I asked it, you know, how do you implement end-to-end TLS with an ALB and Kubernetes pods, I got the right answer, while previously I'd asked ChatGPT the same thing, and maybe it's been fixed now, but I got a hallucination on GPT saying, you could use security groups on your pods to ensure end-to-end TLS. I'm like, whoa, that would be so cool. And that's not true. So this does talk about using a sidecar. Well, interesting. Did I get a different answer this time? All right, let's see here. Let's talk about using, well, the answer I had gotten the first time was a private CA, was using Cert Manager and sidecars. So I'm getting a different answer now. So much for doing everything live. And yes, that's what we can expect of AI these days.
Oh, you still got it with private CA. That's still in your answer.
The answer, oh, there it is, by installing Cert Manager.
Okay. Yeah. That was just giving you all the references to the documentation that it cited.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think AWS private CA issuer is technically required, but that's if you want to use more AWS services. All right. Next announcement was this. First, I was scratching my head, and I'm not an authority on this by any means. I thought it was first pretty asinine or insane that they would even try to do something similar to this. And then, I don't know, at least one use case came to mind that would make sense to me, which is the convenience of having data sets at the edge that you can just use regular SQL syntax within your web apps running at the edge to have efficient lookups of, you know, semi-dynamic data. I think this goes on to say you can do writes as well, but I don't know how that works. And this is based on an open source solution. They offer a hosted version at fly.io. Anyone know more about this? All right. Let's see. Next, this is an oldie but goodie. I'm pretty sure I've seen it before. It's like trended on Hacker News like 25 times. But thought it's worth sharing. It hits close to home. You know, I'd say, you know, we are definitely building something of a framework at Cloud Posse around Terraform and other automation tools. And, you know, once you get to one higher level of sophistication or abstraction, you start to see new problems that you try and solve, and realizing that your former solutions were not, and you just keep jettisoning yourself onto higher orders of abstraction that are hard for new people to grok when they come to the project. And the question is asked, therefore, should we even be doing it at all? So it's a fun little story about, you know, somebody who goes in just to try and get a hammer, kind of like just trying to provision an S3 bucket. And, you know, how easy or hard that may or may not be for you.
There was a gimmick in the past as well that you have to use an interface to call an interface to have an interface that provides an interface.
Yeah. Yeah. Along those lines. And there was a Google post on Google Terraform Resource Factories. Let's see if I find it. Resource Factory pattern. I think it might have been this one. And it, you know, it is a So here's, this talks about a factory. Of course, this is not a factory creating factories, which is where we start getting into problems. But this is a common, more and more common pattern in Terraform. We use it as well. Basically, where your Terraform code looks at a YAML or JSON specification for the list of resources you need in a simplified way. And then as a factory, turns those into Terraform resources, which turn into AWS resources and yada, yada, yada. Okay. Anything else to add to that? Anyone else? So here's a post I didn't get a chance to go deeper on.
Sorry, Sorry, Eric, I was just going to share. I was talking, but I had myself on mute. I was just going to share like the thing I just shared in the link. Maybe just add it to the doc. It's the original, like, it reminded me of somewhat of this, like, tangentially related about, like, yak shaving. It's basically when you just want to do one thing and you end up having this is, I think this actually describes DevOps really well. Like, I just want to do this. And then you're by the end of the day, like you've done 27 other things so that you could do the one thing that you set out to do. So if people read that other article, this is a good one to read at the same time. It's a quick one.
That's good. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, story of my life. This. All right. The Terraform apply as code pattern. This is not an official post, I believe, by HashiCorp, nor endorsed by HashiCorp. I think the post goes into some depth on why Mitchell implemented a interesting provider. For Terraform Cloud. It's a Terraform run resource, which obviously only works if you have like something like a Taco provider. This one is presumably only designed to work with Terraform Cloud. But the idea is that actually, if you do that, you can now actually have your Terraform deciding when other products or workspaces or whatever you call them are applied. It's, I don't know, on the one hand, it sounds like a very elegant solution, but I can't wrap my head around it entirely in terms of what the expected outcome would be doing it this way. And it's kind of like, you know, ask a DBA to solve a certain complex problem. They will, you know, produce a stored procedure for you that can do that. Ask a software developer and they'll come up with, you know, a class or some, you know, code for that. Ask a DevOps engineer and he'll you do it yet another way. Or ask a Terraformer, they'll do it one way. I guess it's using whatever tool you know best and understand, even if it might not be the best tool for the job. It would be interesting, Matt, how this applies. Like, could this be extended to what we do with GitHub Actions, you know?
I think what here is they're basically creating implicit dependency relationships. So they're building, they're manually building a graph essentially.
Yeah.
By using these things, which is, I mean, obviously you can do that, but it becomes very complex to maintain that graph. Like somehow reading the graph through Terraform or through config or through, you know, something seems a lot more efficient, but no one seems to have solved that quite yet from my experience and my, you know, research into this area. So
is the idea that this would be based on modules or resources rather than run triggers that would trigger based on the entire workspace? Like, what's the difference between using this and run triggers?
So, I mean, I think this, go ahead,
Matt.
I was going to say, I think this is like just the way to manage run triggers, I think is what that's how I read it, but maybe I'm misunderstanding how they're doing it.
So, you're going to have to correct me where I'm wrong. It's been a long time since I looked at Terraform Cloud in particular. In Terraform Cloud in particular, you could though set up some sort of dependency relationships between workspaces. I forget if those were called run triggers. So basically,
yeah, those are run triggers.
So yeah, I presume that you know. So this is now moved into HCL, and right. You could then manage with HCL the business logic of what that run trigger relationship is as pure Terraform code.
That's how I see it. It's a way to manage run triggers basically from outside of the UI.
Okay. Well, there is a TFE provider that lets you like at the workspace level, like apply those or have those as like an attribute or whatever that for run triggers, but this may be more granular. It may, I don't know, get down to the module or resource level. Like if I have a module inside of a workspace that changes, instead of like the entire workspace, maybe there's more like logic there rather than the entire workspace triggers another entire workspace, like anytime it runs. I don't know.
Yeah. I wasn't sure. I just dug into it.
It'd be interesting if you could use that then to pass information from like the parent workspace into the child workspaces, and those become variable inputs to the other ones, and
yeah,
conditionally therefore cause triggers to the other workspaces. That might be one. So I haven't dug into this example. Maybe there's a corresponding Git repo that shows the actual code, which would be telling. Fine. All right. Well, yeah, if anyone goes deeper on that, it would be interesting to know what. So yeah, clearly some semi-clickbaity GitHub post by a competitor to Terraform Cloud called Digger HQ. Nonetheless, I thought it was interesting way to compare the prices. It is open source, and you know, you can open pull requests to adjust prices, presumably, and so forth. If so, basically, you know, here if you have 100,000 resources in AWS under management, a relatively small team doing 6 concurrent runs with 100 applies a month, yeah, you can save some money out there. Now, the reason why I pick 100,000 is we tend to deploy very large environments, and I'm not even sure 100,000 resources is sufficient to account for it. You know, when you deploy an ECS cluster, that could be like 100 resources, and the task definitions and the target groups and attachments and load balancers and elastic IPs and all that stuff, it adds up quickly. Can you guys hear the buzzing in the background? We have some maintenance going on.
It's not interfering. You're okay.
Okay, cool. Last two here. This one really came out of left field for me. I would not see this being a product coming out of Datadog. It's gotten really loud here. Sorry. Michael Jenkins, are you on the line? Yeah, there you are. Michael, do you know more about this one? Do you want to talk about it?
I do not know much about it. I'm still learning about it. But when I saw it, it reminded me of the PagerDuty acquisition of Rundeck and how that was an attempt to bring automation into another type of service, PagerDuty being like an incident management service. I can kind of see the benefit of it because this brings the automation for any alerts closer to where the alert monitoring is happening. So while you're building out that monitor for CPU spike, you can add some automation to maybe reboot a server or something like that. But I don't know if you want it in your monitoring stack. You know what I mean? I'm thinking more like keep things doing the one specific job that they're designed to do well and have 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 and have.
Anyone else doing that too?
A little strange.
Can you mute it?
Let me find a mirror mute. There we go. I have used Zoom for like 7 years. I've never heard that happen.
And now you need it.
And have and have
and have and have
and have and have and have and have.
Oh, there it is.
He's probably used this new product and the loop got stuck.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Jenkins was testing the Datadog workflows and entered into an infinite loop there. Sorry, guys. All right. So that's that. Last one, Venkat, you shared. I wasn't following this project. I remember Rancher were early pioneers of running VMs inside of containers. I'm not sure if there's any relationship with KubeVirt and that. Is this something you're using, Venkat?
No, I just saw this on my feed. I have yet to try it out myself. Would be curious to hear if anyone here has done a VM in a container yet. I guess we're just doing containers on this call.
I didn't hear you, Hans. I cut off.
Is this the one about running virtual machines within containers or exactly. The other way around?
No, that way exactly, yeah. The hypervisor in the container.
I feel like I've heard of security folks doing this for testing malware with ZeroVM. But I'd have to Google around and see if I could find that article. But those were back in the days when I was looking into working for Malwarebytes.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the announcements I got. Vlad, did you get anything on the AWS side that was stood out? I just saw lots of incremental updates to things.
Haven't seen anything worth mentioning.
Yeah, same. Anyone else see something interesting worth bringing up?
I'll only just make a sort of anecdote that I think it was a call recently with you, Eric, where we were talking about how ChatGPT has gotten weaker due to various changes to it. And it seems like those have coincided with folks releasing articles about how the interest in AI has started to slope down.
Yeah.
Because the more that it is neutered, the more that it, I guess, the less useful it becomes. And I mean, it's quite a sharp, steep cutoff for me myself. I know that I've been using it less and less, especially with the newer ChatGPT-4 changes. I just find that it doesn't make sense.
Or like I need to relearn my prompt game because either that or my prompts need to, like, you know, please give me a little bit more detail. You know, you can tell me the you don't have to sugarcoat the answer. You can be a little bit more direct. I think it depends. Like, programmatic questions can be a little bit easier, I think, or just like pure.
Well, I think in the example where I think we were looking at DNS records, but it reminded me of, you asked for a change to them and the AI only gave you like a small excerpt.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's happened to me dozens of times where I'll say, hey, can you give me such and such? And instead of actually giving me that, it'll just talk about how that's a viable solution, or here's one way that, you know, I would think about designing this. And you're just like, well, no, this it is. Do this. So
yeah, that's really good. You can't get pretty long answers from it anymore. And it used to be great just for, hey, here's some random data. Can you transform it into a CSV for me or some table? And it can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So I would gladly pay for like various levels of, I don't know, raw access. That would be so cool.
Yeah.
Jeremy, question for you. Is this mostly just impacting the front-facing portal like ChatGPT, or is it also impacting OpenAI's API? If you're like,
I think it's, I think, so I've used, I don't know if you use Charm, some of Charm stuff. I think there's one called Mod. It's a CLI tool that lets you pipe things into chat GPT and it, you know, you give it your OpenAI token. And it's a nice tool. It's pretty handy. You can actually give it a list of files and ask it to find the ones that you think you should delete and then, you know, and stuff like that. I've noticed even with that tool, it's either been slower to process than I even feel is worth it. Or I've noticed that it actually is completely incorrect sometimes because it doesn't follow the prompts anymore. So that one I've noticed. I feel like with that, maybe I would say it's it truly is OpenAI. I also think that Copilot has gotten a little bit better. So when I've used Copilot, I think that I've seen things are sometimes cleaner, sometimes a little more intuitive, but it's a more restricted flow you have to use with Copilot. So
how often would you say you're using Copilot a week or a day?
Well, probably, 10 times a day, maybe if I'm, hacking on various things. So like besides work, if I include when I work on my own servers and various other applications, then it's usually about 10 sort of mini projects a day. Because I just like to, again, I'm a polyglot. I like to work on things that might be in Rust or Go, Haskell. I love Haskell. It's a crazy language. And several other things. And so it's really handy for me to just quickly ask it questions and,
All right. Well, let's get into Q&A. I haven't paid attention if there were any questions yet in the Zoom or Slack. Let's see here. This hours. Oops, I'm Slack team. Doesn't look like any questions. So anyone, anything?
I have a question around Terraform lock files, and it may be better suited towards the next call with Renovate, but like the best way to handle, and again, you've gone over this, I guess, before in previous meetings, but the best way to handle those provider updates, whether, because I, especially with dealing like a lot of workspaces in a single repository, I don't think Dependabot does a good job of kind of handling that lock flow. Maybe Renovate is better for that, suited for that, or maybe even building some GitHub, worker around actually building those binaries manually, or even like through if there's already a pre-existing worker that does that.
Yeah, I would say we don't have a mature advice from Cloud Posse on that. Well, I can tell you what we're doing right now, and it's relatively new based on our work with GitHub Actions and Terraform. So we are not committing the provider lock file. We're using the pinning as in the root module. Then during plan file, a lock file is created. We store that as an artifact, and we use that for apply. So then between plan and apply with an approval in between, we're guaranteed to be using the same provider versions, but it is floating in the sense that the next time you do a plan and there's no lock file there, a new lock file would be recreated. Ironically, the same guy, Maxim Vlaslov, that is going to be on the show at the end of the month, he also wrote this post. I haven't gone deep on it. Have you seen this one? We shared it in the office hours before, I think.
Yeah, that's actually the one I was referring to. I think that was like two weeks ago or so.
Yeah exactly. Yeah. Anyone else have something more strategic in terms of managing lock files?
So we were feeling the pain on my team where we were pinning we weren't necessarily using lock files, but it was basically the same thing. We pinned to a version. The big difference being you don't get the checksums and everything that you get with the typical lock file. And it was pretty painful because we'd go through like 10 or 20 repos and do PRs and the whole approval process just to an update. So we've been experimenting over like the past 45 days with a module that just has every version defined. So we have a module that we've written that we reference in all of our Terraform code. And this module only contains the providers that we're using with the pinned version. So we're still not using the Terraform lock file. You can't check that into the module repo, but we're pinned to a version. And now whenever we whenever we do our updates, we just go to that one repository that has that one module, and we basically do everything all at the same time. So a little bit of a code freeze type of situation where we test stuff out in our non-prod environment, make sure the plans are clean, and then merge into main, and you know, it just goes out everywhere. So the big thing to keep in mind, though, is if you do this, you're not getting the checksum validation that you're getting with the Terraform lock file. You definitely give that up. We also went deep down this rabbit hole. Prior to doing this, we tried doing a Terraform registry proxy and tried doing it. We wanted to proxy the Terraform registry. So we built a fast API that allowed you to point all of your change your source from using the default Terraform registry to your custom registry. And then we basically built a proxy, and then we're doing the whitelisting, the equivalent of what it would have described in the module, but on a registry layer. And that backfired on the submodules or the other references that we had. When you start using Cloud Posse modules, unless we convert everything over, it basically falls apart. So if you own every single part of the stack and you have your own registry for everything, then you're great. But otherwise, if you're using any open source, it just falls over. Unfortunately, you can't set. We built our own proxy that proxied the Terraform registry. It just forwarded requests to the Terraform registry, but we restricted the versions that it had. So, so the idea was, this was before we came up with the module idea. And so now we're using the module. We code for both, that's in public repos. I could post this as well. I would not do the proxy idea. We wasted a few days on that, thinking it was a good idea. It's a huge rabbit hole. And
for the solution you were trying to come up with, I think that was a pretty radical way of trying to do it. I think that if you were using the proxy for other reasons and had the added benefit of having kind of vetted versions that you would allow there, then I could see that as a value add. But the main reason I see for going the former route is so that you can have a gatekeeper and require, and then you can force every Terraform request to go through that proxy versus the module is still just, you know, self, you know.
Yeah. Scouts. So we actually, the proxy code that we have out in one of our repos, we actually supported some number of versions. And then by default, we'd have the latest, whatever we defined. So it's like, if version 5.0 of AWS came out and we only had 4.11, ours 4.11 would be the latest. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of handy, but unfortunately it really just falls over when you use any open source. And we were not about to fork every repo that we're leveraging from Cloud Posse and others.
But so I think it can still be done, but I don't understand.
I think the problem was various modules that we're using had their own provider definitions. And so when they have a provider definition, I believe the source defaults back to the official Terraform registry.
But I think therefore you need to use an actual HTTPS environment variable, which is respected by the underlying Go SDK or with that, like the Go modules for working with HTTP. Mm-hmm. And then your proxy can look at those host names and decide to do whatever it wants to do with that.
I haven't tried that out. I get what you're saying. I would have to see if I would get some SSL verification error, but I imagine I could trust the cert and do some host name.
Yeah, it would be basically be trusting the local server. I don't know. This is me more just scratching an itch or my mental curiosity. I've been wanting to do something like this for a long time, but we've never had a strong enough sponsor to go down this route. And I'm guessing one of the there's like 15 open source Terraform registry solutions out there with different functionality, and I can't keep them straight on what they support, but along the lines of what Artifactory does, right? But just simpler without having to have a full-on Artifactory, you know.
Yeah, I thought about self-publishing as well to a self-hosted registry, whether it's Artifactory or one of those other projects. We end up just going down this proxy route. Yeah. We want to actually host the files and Yeah, it's like a simple YAML file that you load up, I think, as an environment variable. It's like, that's probably a little ugly. I think it's base64 encoded. And it just works. Yeah, happy to share with you folks. I'll drop it in the channel. And feel free to build on it or get it to work. That'd be awesome. But I cannot. We end up calling it quits and just going down the module path. And that's been working out okay.
Yeah, makes sense.
In our specific requirement, we have to kind of prove that we're using the, so we are version pinning, but we're version pinning like to a major like AWS 5, not like to a minor version from a Semver perspective, but we have to like kind of like requirements file, we have to kind of prove that we're using the latest version from a security compliance perspective. So that's the reasoning that we're using lock files. But if there's another way, just kind of proof, so if Sneak or Vanta were to go through that repo, we can say, okay, yeah, it's using the latest. If there's another way of doing that, though, yeah, I'd be open to seeing.
Yeah.
If you do the module approach that I described, could you do like dynamically update your module to grab the latest version, like based off Semver, like say, keep the same major, but then you grab the latest patch or minor. I usually just pin all the way down to the patch. So I'm not.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that.
That might work for a use case. If you have tags in your module repo for the repo that I've described, you might be able to, that'd probably work, assuming that you're following Semver. And
Yeah, cool.
Awesome. Yeah, I could send you a link to the repo that I've got. You're in the channel, right? Somewhere.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll send you a link to it and feel free to see if it works. It does slow down your initialize. So I'm loading up like 10 providers at least. So you can expect some slowness there, but once it's there, you're good to go.
Cool. Thanks.
And then, well, doesn't that also create the problem though? Anywhere you use that, all 10 providers would be, well, I guess it's just the,
Yeah.
Some providers require authentication, but you didn't.
Well, actually, no, not all the providers are being used actively. I was surprised by that because I have like the GitHub provider and a bunch of code that's not using the GitHub provider at all. And it works.
Well, it should work, but it'll still initialize the provider, I think, for.
No, it actually, it doesn't actually initialize it. I'll just drop both links to the things I've just described in the Office Hours channel. So you guys take a look. I haven't had any issues. It does slow down your initialization though.
Yeah. Wasn't sure. I'm confused. At one point I thought they said that wasn't going to be supported anymore, but it seems like it's never gone away. Maybe they just made it a best practice generally not to, but okay. More questions. Let's see here. Chat. Doesn't seem like anything.
I had one thing to sort of, well, it's more to share than the question, really, but sorry.
Yeah, go for it.
So I was on the call maybe a couple of weeks ago, and I think I brought up stuff around, you know, templating and, you know, using cookie cutter and some issues we were running into with that. And I came across a tool which is quite, it seems to have potentially solved our issue with, if you have a cookie cutter template that you want to use across a lot of deployments, and then, you know, those sort of go off into the wild, so to speak, and then they have no relationship to the, you know, from where they originally came. And so this tool, which is called Cruft, I'll put it in the chat.
Yes, we've seen it before.
Oh, but is it mentioned before?
Yes, and no, I mean, so we had the similar problems. We never ended up adopting Cruft. We have it in our back pocket. And I think it'll work better for maybe you were using it with GitHub Action workflows in some way, or I forget where you were using it, but yeah. I think for us to do it in terms of like a reference architecture, it would be not as feasible, but we haven't thoroughly tried it. I like it though. Yeah, did you share the link?
Yeah, I had to put it in the chat.
Yeah, so this is for anyone using Cookie Cutter. If you're annoyed, you can't regenerate it after you've started using it, consider using Corrupt.
Yeah, I suppose to just summarize what I learned about it is the two main things it kind of adds to that you can use pre-existing cookie cutter templates, so you don't have to change anything in terms of that. Mm-hmm. But it retains the variables that you passed, which you can sort of do with cookie cutter. It gives you a replayable, I forgot exactly where it saves it, but it gives you can replay a cookie cutter template, but this does it in a more sort of permanent way. And also it allows you to basically keep your boilerplate code or code that was generated from boilerplate up to date with the template that it was generated from. So say, for example, if you have a cookie cutter template for a particular Terraform deployment and you create a deployment out of that, and then later on you update the boilerplate code with a new, you know, module or new resource, say, the existing repo can be updated by, you know, with that initial boilerplate code, which is a pretty sort of neat feature, and, you know, reusing the variables that you passed to it in the first place. And you can also update the variables, you know, to pass in.
Yeah, I think it seems cool. I'm just you know, seems too good to be true, and you know how that usually works out. So that's why we haven't yet tried it on. But have you been done some more serious testing of it yet, or early stage testing?
It is still early stages. I mean, I'm currently writing a proposal for us to start using it. But from how I've been using it so far, there's not really been any major issues I've run into. Touch wood. Because it's relatively simple. It just adds this sort of extra functionality on top of Cookie Cutter. The main issue really is with managing the merge conflicts effectively downstream. It doesn't have a particularly neat way of doing that. So it creates, I think, the ORIG files, or coming off the top of my head, but it basically, it will create these conflict files, which I haven't yet found a good way of kind of automating that process.
So are you saying there are various other artifacts that it creates to make this process more, or to do what it does? So you have to save those files?
Yes. So if you introduce a new change, like patch files. Pardon?
Or the dot orig sounds like patch files, like standard.
So it will basically, if the upstream has changed and it you run Corrupt update and it recognizes that it's different from the boilerplate code now, it will try to integrate that. If there's a merge conflict, it will basically create that file, the org file, which you then have to go, you know, someone has to go in and manually sort of see the difference between those and fix it themselves.
Oh, okay.
Which, you know, is fine, but it's I feel like it could be a slightly better way of doing it without creating that artifact.
All right. Anyone been using Corrupt? Just curious. All right. I saw it had a poetry distribution. Jeremy White, was this that thing that you'd brought up? It was like some altruistic package system that tried to compensate.
Oh, you mean my question in the...
No, a long time ago. Were you the one that introduced me to poetry as a package manager?
Oh, yeah. I was using that originally for a few different things. I've just used it for Lambdas and other applications. It's nice. I think it's a little bit of a learning curve, but it's worth it compared to using something like straight pip and requirements.txt.
Okay, actually, I was thinking of something else then.
Then you might be thinking of, because I was talking about other things as well in the past, like there was Warp Forge, which was trying to make basically it was a package installer where it's inspired by a game, but yeah, that it was inspired by Git and wanted to make a sort of Git SHA for every single step along a package build so that you could branch and modify packages by their set of steps for builds. Mm-hmm. And that meant that you could actually almost share bits and bobs and branch how your builds work. So right. It's a neat idea. I don't know how far they've gotten with it. I know that it is very, very primordial. And when I tried using it, it's definitely got all the working parts there, but needs more community, needs more practical use for another year before it would feel remotely mature.
In what way is this comparable or different to Nix?
Nix just it's funny. I would say Nix just uses Git or any other kind of there's ways to use Nix with even other version control systems, but Nix doesn't try to implement its own sort of hash system, if you will. When you point Nix at a Git repo, it uses the actual Git repo to enforce whether or not there's been change in a package.
Yeah.
And I hope that this makes sense, by the way, Eric, because I know the other one that I had been talking about for a while, but isn't related, I think, to this, it's related to Docker, is Earthly. And earthly.dev was also a very interesting build system for Docker files. And I haven't used it a lot, but folks have started sharing some very large files with me that made a whole bunch of sense despite their size. So I think I'm getting slowly more convinced that it might be a good way to scale a very large Docker build project. I haven't actually wound up using it in any of my personal projects yet. Probably in another month I will, though.
Also, I've seen for builds.
Oh yeah.
And then easily combining all the layers, because basically each package is a layer. Nothing is really overlaid. It's just more like a merge, what you happen to do then at that Nix.
Yeah, I like that Nix is a very DevOps centered idea. It uses Nickel, and Nickel is the language that allows it to be functional, but maintain almost this expressive nature to it that you don't get with, say, Clojure or other functional languages.
Very Haskell inspired.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions we can get to today?
Yes. I wanted to ask the group in general, do you think Terraform is easy enough to learn for developers to deliver a demo of their code with a simple Terraform plan? You know, nothing as elaborate as you guys have, right? But, you know, just something that will actually set up a VPC and a few servers.
I would, Matt, or who
is it? I was going to ask, it was me. I was going to ask, do you mean, I find that Terraform for demo purposes is pretty easy and easy to get up to speed on and everything else. But to make anything production ready, it's not easy and takes a lot of learning and best practices and a bunch of other things to do that. And as I'm saying that, I see that Vlad wrote the same thing in chat. So Vlad and I are in agreement on this one. So
I wouldn't say Terraform is hard for production, but there's no solution that magically just gives you production code, not just Terraform, it's anything. So
I'm like wondering, you know, if you had like, say, thousands of developers, right? And each one of them is creating a repository. And these repositories have hand-built hardware. There's really no way of testing that any of this code works in any kind of automated fashion, right?
Varying degrees, right? So like, are they writing raw Terraform resources, or have you as a company provided like a library of modules and those?
So the current status quo is that somebody developed a platform and developers are writing to this platform. And I'm postulating that this buggy platform is not necessary. But the pushback that I'm getting is that Terraform will take too long for developers to learn.
I would agree to a certain extent. Not that it take that long to learn, but if you truly have that many developers and have truly these many things, it's not the learning it and the setup and the deployment. It's the ongoing maintenance of it. It's the, you know, pinning and updating of the Terraform versions and the providers and all that stuff that goes, that's operational maintenance and overhead that all of us in this call are used to doing, the developers won't do as much of. This is why my team, we have hundreds of developers deploying hundreds of services, and they all have their own infrastructure they need. My team manages it for them. We're trying to, you know, delegate that to them. So we're looking for options such as Crossplane and others to make that easier. So instead of saying, okay, here's write tons of Terraform where you have no constraints at all, instead we're not sure what, right now we have Terraform modules and we say, these are the approved Terraform modules, you can use these. And using like something like a Terragrunt to say, this is what a standard one looks like, that makes it a little bit easier for them. But I'm also curious about this. So we're looking at Crossplane and other similar initiatives where we provide them standard things, and then they're using it in patterns they're used to, such as kubectl or Helm or whatnot, and they can't go outside the bounds. We're putting in, the problem with Terraform is you can do whatever the hell you want, right? And so it can get messy because they can just do whatever they want.
I'm struggling with the same thing on my org, and we don't even have that many developers. We're a startup, we have, you know, about 50 developers, and I came from a company where what actually got me interested in DevOps work was the fact that we did like, you build it, you run it. So I really enjoyed like the infrastructure parts of my job as a software engineer as well. And I was like, let me learn more about this. But what I have found is that that's not every developer. And most developers, we did a survey recently, and they just want a big green button to push and one click to make everything magically happen to them. And you know, it's making me realize that maybe their way is right too. Like, they don't want to be bothered, and I shouldn't force everyone to care about infrastructure. I guess my point is we're at a crossroads and trying to figure out what's the best way to support our developers, and we don't know that yet.
So the difficulty with our problem is that we want to be cloud agnostic like everybody else, right? We would like to be multi-cloud, but we're not. We're only multi-cloud in the sense that we've used multiple clouds, but when we run out of resources in Azure, we can't go to any other cloud because it's all or nothing in one cloud. And I don't know if you guys face the same problem in different clouds where this seemingly infinite pool of resources is just not infinite. And so that's just one of the components of it. The other component is, for, I'm guessing, as long as the company has existed, they've been writing a layer of proprietary software for everybody to interact with. And it's not in English. It's not bug-free. Far from it. It's not flexible. It doesn't do very much. And I'm trying to see if there is another answer. And yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Makes me think of Vlad's post where he said, you know, platform teams are dead, long live platform teams. It was controversial, and he was being...
I brought that post back to the company.
You did?
Oh, yes. I showed it to the director.
Yeah.
It didn't change anything.